got him, bent, and lifted Black Frankenstein's body on his shoulders for an airplane spin. The fans hushed for a second as all that weight left the mat, then began to shout again when Johnny started twirling the monster in the air. Black Frankenstein bawled like a baby being spanked. There was a noise like a pistol shot. Johnny Lee Richwine cried out and began to topple to the mat. Legs busted. The man, who was called Black Frankenstein, had time to register before he flung himself off the young man's shoulders. He knew very well the sound of popping bones. He'd been against the boys trying an airline spin, but Johnny had wanted to impress the home folks. Black Frankenstein slammed into the mat on his side, and when he sat up, he saw the young hometown wrestler lying a few feet away, grasping at his knee and moaning, this time in genuine pain. The referee was on his feet, not knowing what to do. Black Frankenstein was supposed to be stretched out, and Johnny Lee Richwine was supposed to win this main event. That's how the script went, and everything had gone just fine in the run-through. Black Frankenstein got up. He knew the boy was hurting bad, but he had to stay in character. Lifting his arms over his head, he strutted across the ring in a torrent of cups and popcorn bags, and as he neared the stunned referee, he said in a quiet voice, very much different from his villainous ranting, "Disqualify me and get that kid to a doctor. Huh? Do it now." The referee, a local man who ran a hardware store nearby Belleville, finally made a crisscrossed waving motion that meant disqualification for Black Frankenstein. The huge wrestler made a show of jumping up and down with rage for a minute as the audience hooted and cursed at him, and then he stepped quickly out of the ring to be escorted to his dressing room by a phalanx of policemen. On the long walk, he suffered popcorn in his face, a pelting of ice and spitballs, and obscene gestures from children and senior citizens alike. He had a special fear of grandmotherly old ladies, because one had attacked him with a hat pin a year before in Waycross, Georgia, and tried to boot him in the genitals for good measure. In his dressing room, which was a bench and locker in the football squad room, he stretched as many of the kinks out of his muscles as he could. Some of the aches and pains were permanent, and his shoulders felt as tight as chunks of petrified wood. He unlaced his leather mask and looked at himself in the little cracked mirror that hung inside his locker. He could hardly be called handsome. His hair was shaven right to the skull to allow the mask a good fit, his face marked by the scars of many ring accidents. He remembered exactly where each of those scars had come from. A miscalculated turnbuckle blow in Birmingham, a chair swung too convincingly in Winston-Salem, an impact with the edge of the ring in Sioux Falls, a meeting with a concrete floor in San Antonio. Mistakes in timing caused real injuries in professional wrestling. Johnny Lee Richwine hadn't been balanced well enough to support the weight, and his leg had paid for it. He felt bad about it. But there was nothing he could do. The show must go on. He was 35 years old, and the last 10 years of his life had been spent on the wrestling circuit, following the highways and county roads between city auditoriums, high school gyms, and country fairs. He was known in Kentucky as Lightning Bolt Jones, in Illinois as Brickhouse Perkins, and in a dozen states by similar fearsome aliases. His real name was Joshua Hutchins, and tonight he was a long way from his home in Mobile, Alabama. His broad, flat nose had been broken 3 times and looked it. The last time, he hadn't even bothered to get it set. Under thick black brows, his eyes were deeply set in the pale gray of wood smoke. Another small scar looped around the point of his chin like an upside-down question mark, and the hard lines and angles of his face made him resemble a war-weary African king. He was large to the point of being freakish, a curiosity that people stared at when he walked the streets. Ridges of muscle bulged in his arms, shoulders, and legs. But his stomach was dissolving to flab, the result of too many boxes of glazed donuts consumed in lonely motel rooms. but even carrying a spare truck tire of fat around his midsection, Josh Hutchins moved with grace and power, giving the impression of a tightly coiled spring about to burst free. It was what remained of the explosive force he'd commanded when he was a linebacker for the New Orleans Saints many years and a world ago. Josh showered and soaped the sweat off. Tomorrow night, he was due to wrestle in Garden City, Kansas, which would be a long, dusty trek across the state, and a hot trip, too, because the air conditioner in his car had broken down a few days earlier, and he couldn't afford to get it fixed. His next paycheck would come at the end of the week in Kansas City, where he was to participate in a 7-man free-for-all. He got out of the shower, dried off, and dressed. As he was putting his gear away, the match's promoter came in to tell him that Johnny Lee Richwine had been taken to the hospital and that he'd be okay, but that Josh should be careful leaving the gym because the hometown folks could get a little rough. Josh thanked the man in his quiet voice, zipped up his traveling bag, and said goodnight. His beat-up 6-year-old gray Pontiac was parked in the lot of a 24-hour food giant supermarket. He knew from the experience of many slashed tires not to park any nearer the wrestling arena. While he was so close to the market, Josh went inside and emerged a few minutes later with a package of glazed donuts, some Oreo cookies, and a jug of milk. He drove away, heading south on Highway 81 to the Restwell Motel. His room faced the highway, and the rumble of passing trucks sounded like beasts prowling the darkness. He turned on the Tonight Show, then took off his shirt and smeared Ben Gay on his aching shoulders. It had been a long time since he'd worked out in a gym, though he kept telling himself he was going to start jogging again. His gut was as soft as a marshmallow. He knew he could really get hurt there if his opponents didn't pull the kicks and punches. But he decided to worry about that tomorrow. There was always tomorrow. And he put on his bright red pajamas and lay back in bed to consume his snack and watch the tube. He was halfway through the donuts when an NBC News bulletin interrupted the celebrity chatter. A grim-looking newsman came on with the White House in the background, and he began talking about a high-priority meeting the president had just had with the Secretary of Defense, the Armed Forces Chief of Staff, the Vice President, and other advisors, and that sources confirmed the meeting involved both SAC and NORAD. American air bases, the reporter said with urgency in his voice, might be going to a higher level of readiness. More bulletins would break in as the news was available.
"Don't blow up the world till Sunday," Josh said through a mouthful of donut. "I've got to collect my paycheck first."
Every night the newscasts were filled with the facts or rumor of war. Josh watched the broadcasts and read the newspapers whenever he could, and he understood that nations were jealous and paranoid and downright crazy, but he couldn't fathom why sane leaders didn't just pick up their telephones and talk to each other. What was so tough about talking? Josh was beginning to believe the whole thing was like professional wrestling. The superpowers put on their masks and stomped around, roaring threats and swinging wildly at each other. But it was a game of macho strutting bluff. He couldn't imagine what the world would be like after the nuclear bombs fell. But he knew it'd be pretty damned hard to find a box of glazed donuts in the ashes, and he surely would miss them. He'd started on the Oreos when he looked at the telephone next to the bed and thought of Rose and the boys. His wife had divorced him after he'd left pro football and become a wrestler, and she had custody of their two sons. She still lived in Mobile. Josh visited them whenever the circuit took him down that way. Rose had a good job as a legal secretary, and the last time Josh had seen her, she told him she was engaged to be married to a black attorney at the end of August. Josh missed his sons very much. And sometimes in the arena crowds, he glimpsed the faces of boys who reminded him of them. But the faces were always yelling and jeering at him. It didn't pay, he knew, to think too much about people you loved. There was no point in driving the hurt too deep. He wished Rose well, Sometimes he longed to call her, but he feared a man would answer. Well, he thought as he opened another cookie to get at the creamy stuff, I wasn't cut out to be a family man anyhow. No, sir. I like my freedom too much, and by God, that's just what I've got. He was tired. His body ached, and tomorrow would be a long day. Maybe he'd call the hospital before he left, find out about Johnny Lee Richwine. The boy would be smarter for what he'd learned tonight. Josh left the set on because he liked the sound of human voices, and he slowly fell asleep with a package of Oreos balanced on the mound of his stomach. Big day tomorrow, he thought as he drifted off. Gotta be mean and strong again. Then he slept, snoring softly, his dreams filled with the noise of a crowd shouting for his head. The devotional came on. A minister talked about beating swords into plowshares. Then the Star-Spangled Banner played over scenes of majestic snow-capped mountains, wide waving fields of wheat and corn, running streams, verdant forests, and mighty cities. It ended with an image of the American flag stretched out and immobile on a pole sunk into the surface of the moon. The picture froze, lingered for a few seconds, and then static filled the screen as the local station signed off. Chapter 4. 11:48 p.m. Central Daylight Time, near Wichita, Kansas. They were fighting again. The little girl squeezed her eyes shut and put the pillow over her head, but the voices came through anyway, muffled and distorted, almost inhuman. I'm sick and tired of shit, woman. Get off my back. What am I supposed to do? Just smile when you go out drinking and gambling away money I earned? That money was supposed to go for the rent on this damn trailer and buy some groceries, and by God, you went out and threw it away. Just threw it. Get off my fucking back, I said. Look at you. You look like a worn-out old whore. I'm sick to death of you hanging around here giving me shit all the time. Maybe I ought to do something about that, huh? Maybe I ought to just pack and get my ass out of here. Go on, then. Get out and take that spooky kid with you. I will. Don't you think I won't? The argument went back and forth, their voices getting louder and meaner. The little girl had to come up for air, but she kept her eyes tightly closed and filled her mind with her garden, just outside the window of her cramped bedroom. People came from all over the trailer court to see her garden and to comment on how well the flowers were growing. Mrs. Yeager from next door said the violets were beautiful, but she'd never known them to bloom so late and in such hot weather. The daffodils, snapdragons, and bluebells were growing strong, too, but for a while the little girl had heard them dying. She watered them and kneaded the soil with her fingers, and she'd sat amid her garden in the morning sunlight and watched over her flowers with eyes as blue as robin's eggs. And finally, the death sounds went away. Now the garden was a healthy blaze of color, and even most of the grass around the trailer was a rich, dark green. Mrs. Yeager's grass was brown, though she hosed it down almost every day. But the little girl had heard it die a long time ago, though she didn't want to make Mrs. Yeager sad by saying so. Maybe it would come back when the rain fell. A profusion of potted plants filled the bedroom, sitting on cinder block shelves and crowded around the bed. The room held the heady aroma of life, and even a small cactus in a red ceramic pot had sprouted a white flower. The little girl liked to think of her garden and her plants when Tommy and her mother were fighting. She could see the garden in her mind, could visualize all the colors and the petals and feel the earth between her fingers, and those things helped take her away from the voices. Don't you touch me, her mother shouted. You bastard, don't you dare hit me again. I'll knock you on your ass if I want to. There was the sound of a struggle, more cursing, followed by the noise of a slap. The little girl flinched
Tears wetted her closed blonde eyelashes. "Stop fighting," she thought frantically. "Please, please, please stop fighting. Get away from me." Something hit the wall and shattered. The child put her hands over her ears and lay rigidly in bed, about to scream. There was a light, a soft light, blinking against her eyelids. She opened her eyes and sat up. And there, on the window screen, across the room, was a pulsing mass of light, a pale yellow glow like a thousand tiny birthday candles. The light shifted like the swirls of an incandescent painting, and as the child stared at it, entranced, the noise of the fighting got quieter and far away. The light reflected in her wide eyes, moved over her heart-shaped face, and danced in her shoulder-length blonde hair. The entire room was illuminated by the glow of the light creature that clung to the window screen. Fireflies, she realized. Hundreds of fireflies clinging to the screen. She'd seen them on the window before, but never so many, and never all blinking at the same time. They pulsed like stars trying to burn their way through the screen. And as she stared at them, she no longer heard the awful voices of her mother and Uncle Tommy. The blinking fireflies commanded all her attention, their patterns of light mesmerizing her. The language of light changed, took on a different, faster rhythm. The little girl remembered a hall of mirrors at the state fair and how the lights had reflected dazzlingly off the polished glass. Now she felt as if she were standing at the center of a thousand lamps. And as the rhythm became faster and faster, they seemed to whirl around her with dizzying speed. They're talking, she thought, talking in their own language, talking about something very, very important. Swan, honey, wake up. Talking about something about to happen. Can't you hear me? Something bad about to happen real soon. Swan! Someone was shaking her. For a few seconds, she was lost in the hall of mirrors and blinded by the flashing lights. Then she remembered where she was, and she saw the fireflies leaving the window screen, rising up into the night.
Goddamn bugs all over the window, she heard Tommy say.
Swan pulled her gaze away from them with an effort that strained her neck. Her mother stood over her, and in the light from the open door, Swan could see the purple swelling around her mother's right eye. The woman was thin and haggard, with tangled blonde hair showing dark brown roots. She glanced back and forth between her daughter's face and the last of the insects flying off the screen.
What's wrong with you?
She's spooky, Tommy said, his thick-shouldered body blocking the doorway. He was stocky and unkempt, with a scraggly brown beard covering his angular jaw, his face thick-jowled and fleshy. He wore a red cap, a T-shirt, and overalls. She's fucked up in the head, he said, and he swigged from a bottle of Miller High Life.
Mama?
The child was still dazed, the lights blinking behind her eyes.
Honey, I want you to get up and put your clothes on. We're leaving this damn dump right now, you hear me? Yes, ma'am.
You ain't going nowhere, Tommy sneered. Where are you gonna go?
As far away as we can get. I was stupid to move in here with you in the first place. Get up now, honey. Put your clothes on. We want to be out of here as soon as we can.
You gonna go back to Rick Dawson? Yeah, you go on. He kicked you out once before, and I picked you up. Go on, and let him kick you again.
She turned toward him and said coldly,
Get out of my way, or so help me God, I'll kill you.
Tommy's eyes were hooded and dangerous. He drank from the bottle again, licked his lips, and then laughed.
Sure.
He stepped back and made an exaggerated sweeping gesture with his arm.
Come on through. You think you're a goddamn queen. Come on through.
She looked at her child with a glance that urged her to hurry and walked past him out of the bedroom. Swan got out of bed
and clad in her 9-year-old girl-sized Wichita State University nightshirt, hurried to the window and peered outside. The lights of Mrs. Yeager's trailer next door were on, and Swan figured the noise had probably awakened her. Swan looked upward and stared open-mouthed with awe. The sky was filled with waves of moving, blinking stars. Wheels of light rolled across the darkness over the trailer court, and streaks of yellow fire zigzagged upward into the haze that obscured the moon. Thousands upon thousands of fireflies were passing overhead like galaxies in motion, their signals forming chains of light that stretched from west to east as far as Swan could see. From somewhere in the trailer park, a dog began to howl. The noise was picked up by a second dog, then a third, then from other dogs in the subdivision across Highway 15. More lights were going on in the trailers, and people were stepping outside to see what was happening. "God almighty, what a racket!" Tommy was still standing in the doorway. He bellowed, "Shut the fuck up!" and then finished the rest of his beer with one angry gulp. He fixed Swan with a baleful, bleary-eyed gaze. "Yeah, I'll be glad to get rid of you, kid. Look at this damned room, all these plants and shit. Christ, this is a trailer, not a greenhouse." He kicked over a pot of geraniums, and Swan flinched. But she stood her ground, her chin uplifted, and waited for him to leave. "You want to know about your mama, kid?" he asked her slyly. "Want to know about that bar where she dances on tables and lets men touch her titties?"
"Shut up, you bastard!"
the woman shouted, and Tommy spun around in time to stop her swing against his forearm. He shoved her away. "Yeah, come on, Darlene. Show that kid what you're made of. Tell her about the men you've been through, and, oh, yeah, tell her all about her daddy. Tell her you were so high on LSD and PCP and God knows what else that you don't even remember the fucker's name." Darlene Prescott's face was contorted with anger. Years ago, she'd been a pretty woman, with strong cheekbones and dark blue eyes that communicated a sexual challenge to any number of men. But now, her face was tired and sagging, and deep lines cut across her forehead and around her mouth. She was only 32, but looked at least 5 years older. She was squeezed into tight blue jeans and wore a yellow cowgirl blouse with spangles on the shoulders. She turned away from Tommy and went into the trailer's master bedroom, her lizard-skin cowboy boots clumping on the floor.
"Hey,"
Tommy said, giggling.
"Don't run off mad."
Swan began to take her clothes out of the dresser drawers, but her mother returned with a suitcase already full of gaudy outfits and boots and shoveled as much of Swan's clothes into it as would fit.
"We're going right now," she told her daughter. "Come on."
Swan paused, looking around at the room full of flowers and plants.
"No," she thought, "I can't leave all my flowers in my garden. Who will water my garden?"
Darlene leaned down on the suitcase, pressed it shut, and snapped it. Then she grasped Swan's hand and turned to go. Swan had time only to grab her Cookie Monster doll before she was pulled out of the room in her mother's wake. Tommy followed behind them, a fresh beer in hand.
"Yeah, you go on. You'll be back by tomorrow night, Darlene. You just wait and see."
"I'll wait," she replied, and she pushed through the screen door. Outside in the steamy night, the howling of dogs floated from all directions. Banners of light streamed across the sky. Darlene glanced up at them, but didn't hesitate in her long stride toward the bright red Camaro parked at the curb behind Tommy's souped-up Chevy pickup truck. Darlene threw the suitcase in the back seat and slid under the wheel as Swan, still in her nightshirt, got in the passenger's side.
"Bastard," Darlene breathed as she fumbled with her keys. "I'll show his ass." "Hey, look at me,"
Tommy yelled, and Swan looked. She was horrified to see that he was dancing in her garden.
the sharp toes of his boots kicking up clumps of dirt, the heels mashing her flowers dead. She clasped her hands to her ears because she heard their hurting sounds rising up like the strings of a steel guitar being plucked. Tommy grinned and capered, took off his cap and threw it into the air. A white-hot anger flared within Swan, and she wished Uncle Tommy dead for hurting her garden. But then the flash of anger passed, leaving her feeling sick to her stomach. She saw him clearly for what he was, a fat, balding fool, his only possessions in the world a broken-down trailer and a pickup truck. This was where he'd grow old and die without letting anyone love him, because he was afraid, just like her mother was, of getting too close. She saw all that and understood it in a second, and she knew that his pleasure at destroying her garden would end with him, as usual, on his knees in the bathroom over the toilet, and when he was through being sick, he would sleep alone and wake up alone. But she could always grow another garden, and she would, in the next place they went to, wherever that was going to be. She said, "Uncle Tommy?" He stopped dancing, his mouth leering at her and a curse on his lip. "I forgive you," Swan said softly, and the man stared at her as if she'd struck him across the face. But Darlene Prescott shouted, "Fuck you!" at him, and the Camaro's engine fired like the roar of a cannon. Darlene jammed her foot down on the accelerator, laying rubber for 30 feet before the tires caught and rocketed them out of the Highway 15 trailer park forever. "Where are we going?" Swan asked, cuddling Cookie Monster after the noise of the shrieking tires had faded. "Well, I figure we'll find us a motel to spend the night in, then I'll go by the bar in the morning and try to get some money from Frankie." She shrugged. "Maybe he'll give me $50, maybe." "Are we going back to Uncle Tommy?" "No," Darlene said firmly. "I'm through with him. He's the meanest man I've ever known, and by Christ, I can't understand what I ever saw in him." Swan recalled that she'd said the same thing about both Uncle Rick and Uncle Alex. She paused thoughtfully, trying to decide whether to ask the question or not, and then she drew a deep breath and said, "Is it true, Mama, what Tommy said about you not knowing who my daddy really was?" "Don't you say that," she snapped. She riveted her attention on the long ribbon of road. "Don't you ever think such a thing, young lady. I've told you before. Your daddy's a famous rock and roll star. He's got blonde curly hair and blue eyes like yours, the blue eyes of an angel dropped to earth. And can he play a guitar and sing? Can birds fly? Lord, yes. And I've told you time and again that as soon as he divorces his wife, we're going to go out and live in Hollywood, California. Won't that be something? You and me on that Sunset Strip?" "Yes, ma'am," Swan said listlessly. She'd heard that story before. All Swan wanted was to live in one place for more than 4 or 5 months, so she could make friends she wouldn't be afraid of losing, and go to the same school for a whole year. Because she had no friends, she turned all her energy and attention to her flowers and plants, spending hours creating gardens in the rough earth of trailer parks, boarding houses, and cheap motels. "Let's get us some music on the radio," Darlene said. She switched it on, and rock and roll blared from the speakers. The volume was turned so loud that Darlene didn't have to think about the lie that she'd told her daughter time and again. In truth, she only knew that he was a tall, blonde hunk whose rubber had broken in mid-thrust. It hadn't mattered at the time. The party was going on, and in the next room everybody was raising hell, and both Darlene and the hunk were flying high on a mixture of LSD, angel dust, and poppers. That had been when she was living in Las Vegas 9 years ago, working as a blackjack dealer. And since then, she and Swan had lived all over the West,
following men who promised to be fun for a while or taking jobs as a topless dancer wherever she could find them. Now, though, Darlene didn't know where they were going. She was sick of Tommy, but she was afraid of him, too. He was too crazy, too mean. It was likely he'd come after them in a day or so if she didn't get far enough away. Frankie at the High Noon Saloon where she danced might advance her some money on her next paycheck, but then where? Home, she thought. Home was a little speck called Blakeman up in Rollins County in the northwest corner of Kansas. She'd run away when she was 16 after her mother had died of cancer and her father had started going crazy on religion. She knew the old man hated her, and that's why she'd left. What would home be like now, she wondered. She imagined her father would drop his teeth when he found out he had a granddaughter. Hell no, I can't go back there. But she was already calculating the route she would take if she did decide to go to Blakeman. North on 135 to Salina, west through the sweeping corn and wheat fields on Interstate 70, north again on arrow straight country roads. She could get enough money from Frankie to pay for the gas. How'd you like to take a trip in the morning? Where to? She clutched the Cookie Monster tighter. Oh, just somewhere. A little town called Blakeman. Not much going on the last time I was there. Maybe we could go there and rest for a few days, get our heads together and think, right? Swan shrugged. I guess, she said, but she didn't care one way or the other. Darlene turned the radio down and put her arm around her daughter. Looking up, she thought she saw a glimmer of light in the sky, but then it was gone. She squeezed Swan's shoulder. Just you and me against the world, kid, she said. And know what? We're going to win out yet if we just keep on slugging. Swan looked at her mother and wanted very badly to believe. The Camaro continued into the night along the unfolding highway, and in the clouds, hundreds of feet above, living chains of light linked across the heavens. Chapter 5. 11:50 p.m. Mountain Daylight Time, Blue Dome Mountain, Idaho. A gunmetal gray Ford Roamer recreational vehicle climbed the narrow winding road that led to the top of Blue Dome Mountain, 11,000 feet above sea level and 60 miles northwest of Idaho Falls. On both sides of the road, dense pine forests clung to harsh ribs of stone. The RV's headlights bored holes in a low-lying mist, and the lights of the instrument panel glowed green on the drawn, tired face of the middle-aged man behind the wheel. In the reclined seat beside him, his wife was sleeping with a map of Idaho unfolded on her lap. On the next long curve, the headlights hit a sign on the roadside that said in bright orange luminescent letters, "Private property. Trespassers will be shot." Phil Croninger slowed the RV, but he had the plastic ID card they'd mailed him in his wallet. So he kept going past the forbidding sign and onward up the mountain road. "Would they really do that, Dad?" his son asked in a reedy voice from the seat behind him. "Do what? Shoot trespassers? Would they really?" "You know it. They don't want anybody up here who doesn't belong." He glanced at the rearview mirror and caught his son's green-daubed face floating like a Halloween mask over his shoulder. Father and son closely resembled each other. They both wore thick-lensed eyeglasses, had thin, lank hair, and were slight and bony. Phil's hair was threaded with gray and was receding rapidly, and the 13-year-old boy's was dark brown, cut in straight bangs to hide the height of his forehead. The boy's face was a study in sharp angles, like his mother's. His nose, chin, and cheekbones all seemed to be about to slice through his pallid skin, as if a second face were underneath the first and on the edge of being revealed. His eyes, magnified slightly by the lenses, were the color of ashes. He wore a T-shirt done in military camouflage colors, a pair of khaki shorts and hiking boots. Elise Croninger stirred.
"Are we there yet?" she asked sleepily,
Almost. We should see something pretty soon. It had been a long, tiring trip from Flagstaff, and Phil had insisted on traveling at night because, by his calculations, the cooler temperatures were kinder on the tires and boosted gas mileage. He was a careful man who took no chances.
I'll bet they're looking at us right now with radar.
The boy stared toward the woods.
I'll bet they're really taking us apart.
Could be, Phil agreed. They've got about everything you can think of up here. It's a terrific place. Wait till you see it.
I hope it's cool in there,
Elise said irritably.
God knows I didn't come all this way to cook in a mine shaft.
It's not a mine shaft, Phil reminded her. Anyway, it's naturally cool, and they've got all sorts of air filtration systems and safety stuff. You'll see.
The boy said, They're watching us. I can feel them watching us.
He felt under his seat for what he knew was hidden there, and his hand came out with a .357 Magnum.
Bang! He said,
and he clicked the trigger toward the dark woods on his right, and another bang to the left.
Put that thing down, Roland, his mother told him.
Put it away, son. We don't want it out in the open. Roland Croninger hesitated and grinned slyly. He pointed the gun at the center of his mother's head, pulled the trigger, and said quietly, Bang! And then a bang and a click of the trigger at his father's skull. Roland, his father said in what passed for a stern voice, Stop kidding around now. Put the gun away.
Roland,
his mother warned.
Ah, heck.
He shoved the weapon back under the seat.
I was just having some fun. You two take everything so seriously.
There was a sudden jolt as Phil Croninger planted his foot on the brake pedal. Two men in green helmets and camouflage uniforms were standing in the middle of the road. Both of them were holding Ingram submachine guns and had .45s and holsters at their waists. The Ingram guns were pointed right at the RV's windshield.
Jesus, Phil whispered.
One of the soldiers motioned for him to roll down the window. When Phil had done so, the soldier stepped around to his side of the RV, snapped on a flashlight, and shone it in his face. ID, please, the soldier said. He was a young man with a hard face and electric blue eyes. Phil brought out his wallet and the ID card and handed it to the young man, who examined Phil's photograph on the card. How many coming in, sir? The soldier asked.
Three.
Me, my wife, and son. We are expected. The young man gave Phil's card to the other soldier, who unclipped a walkie-talkie from his utility belt. Phil heard him say, Central, this is checkpoint. We've got three coming up in a gray recreational vehicle. Name on the cards, Philip Austin Croninger. Computer number 0-671-4724. I'll hold for confirmation.
Wow, Roland whispered excitedly. This is just like the war movies.
Shh, his father warned. Roland admired the soldiers' uniforms. He noted that the boots were spit-shined and the camouflage trousers still held creases. Above each soldier's heart was a patch that depicted an armored fist gripping a lightning bolt, and below the symbol was Earth House, stitched in gold. Okay, thank you, Central, the soldier with the walkie-talkie said. He returned the card to the other one, who handed it to Phil. There you go, sir. Your ETA was 10:45. Sorry. Phil took the card and put it away in his wallet. We stopped for a late dinner. Just follow the road, the young man explained. About a quarter mile ahead, you'll see a stop sign. Make sure your tires are lined up with the marks. Okay? Drive on. He gave a quick motion with his arm, and as the second soldier stepped aside, Phil accelerated away from the checkpoint. When he glanced in the side-view mirror again, he saw the soldiers re-entering the forest.
"Does everybody get a uniform, Dad?"
Roland asked. "No, I'm afraid not. Just the men who work here wear uniforms."
"I didn't even see them," Elise said, still nervous. I just looked up, and there they were. They were pointing those guns right at us. What if one had gone off?"
"These people are professionals, hon. They wouldn't be here if they didn't know what they were doing, and I'm sure all of them know how to handle guns. That just shows you how secure we're going to be for the next 2 weeks. Nobody can get up here who doesn't belong, right?
Right,
Roland said. He'd experienced a thrill of excitement when he'd looked down the barrels of those two Ingram guns. If they'd wanted to, he thought, they could have blown us all away with a single burst. One squeeze of the trigger and zap! The feeling left him amazingly invigorated, as if cold water had been splashed in his face. That was good, he thought. Very good. One of the qualities of a king's knight was to take danger in stride. There's the stop sign, Phil told him as the headlights hit it dead ahead. The large sign was affixed to a wall of rough, jagged rock that ended the mountain road. Around them were only dark woods and the rise of more rocky walls. There was no sign of the place they'd come from Flagstaff to find.
How do you get inside?
Elise asked. You'll see. This was one of the neatest things they showed me. Phil had been here in April after he'd read an advertisement for Earth House in Soldier of Fortune magazine. He slowly guided the roamer forward until its front tires sank into two grooves in the earth and triggered a pair of latches. Almost immediately, there was a deep rumbling sound, the noise of heavy machinery, gears, and chains at work. A crack of fluorescent light appeared at the base of the rock wall. A section of it was smoothly ascending, like the door of the Croninger garage at home. But to Roland Croninger, it looked like the opening of a massive portal into a medieval fortress. His heart had begun to pound, and the crack of fluorescent light reflected in the lens of his glasses grew wider and brighter.
"My God,"
Elise said softly. The rock wall was opening to reveal a concrete-floored parking deck, its spaces filled with cars and other recreational vehicles. A row of lights hung from a gridwork of iron beams at the ceiling. In the doorway stood a uniformed soldier waving Phil to come ahead. He eased forward, the grooves guiding the roamer down a concrete ramp and onto the parking deck. As soon as the tires had disengaged the latches again, the doorway began to rumble shut. The soldier motioned Phil along to a parking place between two other campers and made a gesture with a finger across his throat.
"What's that mean?"
Elise asked uneasily. Phil smiled. "He's telling us to cut the engine." He did. "We're here, gang." The rock doorway closed with a solid, echoing thunk, and the outside world was sealed off. "We're in the army now," Phil told his son, and the boy's expression was one of dreamy amazement. As they got out of the roamer, two electric carts pulled up. In the first one was a smiling young man, his hair sandy brown and clipped in a crew cut, wearing a dark blue uniform with the Earth House insignia on his breast pocket. The second cart carried two husky men in dark blue jumpsuits and pulled a flat luggage trailer like those used at airports. The smiling young man, whose white teeth seemed to reflect the fluorescent lighting, checked the information on his clipboard to make sure he had the name right. "Hi, folks," he said cheerfully. "Mr. and Mrs. Philip Croninger?" "Right," Phil said. "And our son, Roland." "Hi, Roland. You folks have a good trip from Flagstaff?"
"A long trip," Elise told him.
She gawked around at the parking deck, figuring there were well over 200 cars.
"My God, how many people are here?"
"We're about 95% of capacity, Mrs. Croninger. We figure to be 100% by the weekend. Mr. Croninger, if you'll give these two gentlemen your keys, they'll bring your luggage along for you." Phil did, and the two men began to unload suitcases and boxes from the roamer.
"I've got computer equipment," Roland told the young man. "It'll be okay, won't it?"
"Sure will. You folks just hop aboard here, and I'll take you to your quarters." "Corporal Matthias," he said, addressing one of the baggage handlers, "those go to Section C, number 16. You folks ready?" Phil had gotten into the front passenger's seat, and his wife and son in the back. Phil nodded, and the young man drove them across the parking deck and into a corridor. concrete floored and lined with lights that angled gently downward. A cool breeze circulated from an occasional strategically placed ceiling fan. Other corridors branched off from the first, and there were arrows that pointed to sections A, B, and C. "I am Hospitality Sergeant Shore," the young man offered his hand, and Phil shook it. "Glad to have you with us. Are there any questions I can answer for you?" "Well, I've taken the tour back in April, and I know about Earth House," Phil explained. "But I don't think my wife and son got the full impact from the pamphlets." "Elise was worried about the air circulation down here," Shore laughed. "Not to worry, Mrs. Groninger. We've got two state-of-the-art air filtration systems, one online and one backup. The system would power up within 1 minute of a code red. That's when we're expecting impact, and we seal the vents. Right now, though, the fans are drawing in plenty of air from outside, and I can guarantee you that the air on Blue Dome Mountain is probably the cleanest you'll ever breathe. We've got three living areas, sections A, B, and C on this level, and underneath us is the command center and maintenance level. Down there, 50 feet below us, is the generator room, the weapons supply, the emergency food and water supply, the radar room, and the officers' quarters. By the way, we have a policy of storing all incoming firearms in our weapons supply. Did you happen to have any with you? 357 Magnum, Phil said, under the back seat. I didn't know about that policy. Well, I'm sure you overlooked it in the contract you signed, but I think you'll agree all firearms should be localized for the safety of Earth House residents, right? He smiled at Phil, and Phil nodded. We'll code it and give you a receipt, and when you leave us in 2 weeks, you'll get it back cleaned and shining.
What kinds of weapons do you have down there? Roland asked eagerly.
Oh, pistols, automatic rifles, submachine guns, mortars, flamethrowers, grenades, anti-personnel and anti-vehicle mines, flares. About everything you can think of. And, of course, we keep our gas masks and anti-radiation suits down there, too. When this place was put together, Colonel Macklin wanted it to be an impregnable fortress, and that's exactly what it is. Colonel Macklin, Roland thought. Colonel James Jimbo Macklin. Roland was familiar with the name through articles in the survivalist and weaponry magazines that his father subscribed to. Colonel Macklin had a long record of success as a 105D Thunder Chief pilot over North Vietnam. Had been shot down in 1971 and had been a POW until the end of the war. Then he'd gone back into Vietnam and Indochina looking for MIAs and had fought with Soldiers of Fortune in South Africa, Chad, and Lebanon.
Will we get to meet Colonel Macklin?
Orientation is at 0800 hours sharp in the town hall. He'll be there. They saw a sign reading Section C with an arrow pointing to the right. Sergeant Shore turned off the main corridor, and the tires jumbled over bits of concrete and rock that littered the floor. Water was dripping from above in a widening puddle, and it wet all of them before Shore could brake the cart. Shore looked back, his smile slipping. He stopped the cart, and the Groninger saw that part of the ceiling, the size of a manhole cover, had collapsed. Exposed in the hole were iron bars and chicken wire. Shore took a walkie-talkie from the cart's dash, clicked it on, and said, "This is Shore. Near the junction of Central and C corridors, I've got a drainage problem here. Need a clean-up crew on the double. You read me?"
"Read you," a voice replied, weakened by static.
"Trouble again?"
"I've got new arrivals with me, Corporal."
"Sorry, sir. The clean-up crew's on the way."
Shore switched off the walkie-talkie. His smile returned, but his light brown eyes were uneasy.
"Minor problem, folks. Earth House has a top-line drainage system, but you know, sometimes we get these minor leaks. Clean-up crew will take care of it."
Elise pointed upward. She'd noticed the jigsaw of cracks and patches in the ceiling.
"That doesn't look too safe. What if that thing falls in?"
She looked wide-eyed at her husband.
"My God, Phil! Are we supposed to stay here for 2 weeks under a leaking mountain?"
"Mrs. Groninger,"
Shore said in his most soothing voice. Earth House wouldn't be at 95% capacity if it wasn't safe. Now, I agree, the drainage system needs work, and we are getting it in shape, but there is absolutely no danger. We've had structural engineers and stress specialists inspect Earth House, and all of them gave it the okay. This is a survivalist condominium, Mrs. Croninger. We wouldn't be here if we didn't want to survive the coming Holocaust, right? Elise glanced back and forth between her husband and the young man. Her husband had paid $50,000 for membership in the Earth House timesharing plan, 2 weeks every year for life, in what the pamphlets called a luxurious survivalist fortress in the mountains of southern Idaho. Of course, she believed the nuclear holocaust was coming soon, too. Phil had shelves of books on nuclear war and was convinced that it would happen within a year, and that the United States would be driven to its knees by the Russian invaders. He had wanted to find a place, as he told her, to make a last stand. But she tried to talk him out of it, telling him that he was betting $50,000 that nuclear disaster would happen during one of their 2 week timesharing periods, and that was a pretty crazy gamble. He'd explained to her the Earth House protection option, which meant that for an extra $5,000 a year, the Croninger family could find refuge in Earth House at any time within 24 hours of the detonation of an enemy-fired nuclear missile within the continental United States. It was Holocaust insurance, he told her. Everybody knew the bombs were going to fall. It was just a question of when. And Phil Croninger was very aware of the importance of insurance because he owned one of the largest independent insurance agencies in Arizona. I suppose, she finally said. But she was troubled by those cracks and patches and by the sight of that flimsy chicken wire sticking out of the new hole. Sergeant Shore accelerated the electric cart. They passed metal doorways on both sides of the corridor. "Must have cost a lot of money to build this place," Roland said, and Shore nodded. "A few million," Shore said, "not counting loose change. A couple of brothers from Texas put the money into it. They're survivalists, too. They got rich off oil wells. This place used to be a silver mine back in the 40s and 50s, but the load ran out and it just sat here for years until the Ostleys bought it. Here we are, just ahead." He slowed the cart and stopped in front of a metal door marked 16. "Your home sweet home for the next 2 weeks, folks." He opened the door with a key affixed to an Earth House insignia keychain, reached inside, and switched on the lights. Before she followed her husband and son over the threshold, Elise Croninger heard the sound of water dripping, and she saw another puddle spreading in the corridor. The ceiling was leaking in three places, and there was a long, jagged crack 2 inches wide. Jesus, she thought, unnerved. But she stepped into the room anyway. Her first impression was of the starkness of a military barracks. The walls were beige-painted cinder block, decorated with a few oil paintings. The carpet was thick enough and not a bad color of rust red. But the ceiling seemed awfully low to her, though it cleared Phil's head by about 6 inches, and he was 5'11". The apparent lack of height in the suite's living area, as the pamphlets had called it, made her feel almost... yes, she thought, almost entombed. One nice touch, though, was that the entire far wall was a photographic mural of snow-capped mountains opening up the room a little, if just by optical illusion. There were two bedrooms and a single bathroom connecting them. Sergeant Shore took a few minutes to show them around, demonstrating the whooshing toilet that flushed upward to a tank. He said that delivered the waste materials to the forest floor and so aided the vegetation growth. The bedrooms were also of beige-painted cinder block, and the ceilings were made of cork tile that presumably Elise thought hid the latticework of iron beams and reinforcing rods. "It's great, isn't it?" Phil asked her. "Isn't this something?" "I'm not sure yet," she replied. "I still feel like I'm in a mine shaft.
Oh, that'll pass, Shore told her amiably. Some of the first-timers get claustrophobia, but it wears off. Now, let me give you this, he said. And he handed Phil an Earth House map that unfolded to show the cafeteria, the gymnasium, the infirmary, and the arcade game room. The town hall's right here, he said, and he pointed on the map. It's really just an auditorium, but we figure we're a community down here, right? Let me show you the quickest way to get there from here. In his bedroom, the smaller of the two, Roland had switched on the bedside lamp and was scouting a suitable electrical outlet for his computer. The room was small, but he thought it was okay. It was the atmosphere that was important. And he looked forward to the seminars on improvised weapons, living off the land, governments in chaos, and guerrilla tactics that the pamphlets had promised. He found a good outlet, near enough to the bed, so he could prop himself up on pillows while he programmed the King's Knight game on his computer. In the next 2 weeks, he thought, he was going to dream up dungeons and monsters to roam them that would make even an expert, jaded King's Knight like himself tremble in his jambos. Roland went to the closet and opened it to see how much room he had to store his stuff. The inside was cheaply paneled, a few wire hangers dangling from the rod. But something small and yellow suddenly flitted like an autumn leaf from the back of the closet. Roland instinctively reached out and caught it, closing his fingers around it. Then he walked over to the light and carefully opened his palm. Lying stunned in his hand was a fragile yellow butterfly, with streaks of green and gold along its wings. Its eyes were dark green pinheads, like gleaming emeralds. The butterfly fluttered, weak and dazed. "How long have you been in there?" Roland wondered. No telling. Probably came in on somebody's car or camper or in their clothes. He lifted his hand closer to his face and stared for a few seconds into the creature's tiny eyes. And then he crushed the butterfly in his fist, feeling the body smear under the power of his grip. Zap, he thought. Super zap. He sure hadn't come all the way from Flagstaff, he told himself, to share a room with a fucking yellow bug. He dropped the mangled remnant into a wastebasket, then wiped the iridescent yellow sparkle from his palm onto his khakis and went back to the living room. Shore was saying goodnight, and the other two men had just arrived with the luggage and Roland's computer gear. "Orientation at 0800, folks," Shore said. "See you there." "Great," Phil Croninger said excitedly. "Great," Elise's voice delivered the jab of sarcasm. Sergeant Shore, smile still locked in place, left number 16. But the smile disappeared as he stepped into the electric cart, and his mouth became a grim, rigid line. He turned the cart around and raced back to the area where the rubble lay on the floor, and he told the cleanup crew that they'd better move their asses to patch those cracks, and this time keep them patched, before the whole goddamn section fell apart. Part 2. Burning Spears. The Man Who Liked Movies. Judgment Day. The Greeter. Underground Boys. Discipline and Control Makes the Man. Charter. Chapter 6. July 17th, 4:40 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time. New York City.
"He's still in there, ain't he?"
the black woman with orange hair asked in a whisper, and the Hispanic boy behind the candy counter nodded.
"Listen,"
the boy, whose name was Emiliano Sanchez, said, and his dark eyes widened. From beyond the faded red curtains that led into the auditorium of the Empire State Theater on 42nd Street, there came a laugh. It was a sound someone with a slashed throat might have made. The sound of it grew louder and higher, and Emiliano put his hands to his ears. The laughter had reminded him of a locomotive whistle and a child's shriek, and for a few seconds he was back in time, 8 years old and living in Mexico City, witnessing his kid brother being struck and killed by a freight train. Cecily stared at him, and as the laughter rose in volume, she heard a girl scream in it, and she was 14 years old and lying on the abortionist's table as the job was done. The vision was gone in an instant, and the laughter began to fade.
"Jesus Christ," Cecily managed to say, whispering again. "What's that bastard smoking?"
"I've been listening to that since midnight," he told her. His shift had started.